It's been an exciting time in which to live, and what's going to happen in your generation will be, I hope, even a greater thrust forward in at least making the outsider aware of our common unity under the one capital T, which is Christ himself. He is the tradition in the church, as the fathers put it. That is, the church fathers, 2nd, 3rd century, wrote to this, and they said the living tradition is the living Christ himself, and he's the one who shapes us into one. And that, in a wonderful way, comes through from this particular background that Ernest Becker is exposing for us. His great concern is that you don't feel so overweighted by the availability of knowledge that you just give up, that there's just so much that you feel it's hopeless. This kind of a computer time when you almost have to have a computer kind of memory. I can assure you, if you had that kind of memory, you'd be no good at all. The man that I know with the best memory, he's one of those one in every 200,000 that has actually got a photographic memory. Leo Buster, a friend of these fellows, knows him. They both come from the same town. Yarley Larfarm and I could be waiting for a freight train at a railroad track, for example, and there'd be 100 cars going past us, and then he'd play off the numbers of them afterwards. He'd just roll it back, you know, at you. Not any imagination, unfortunately. There's a price you pay for that, and that you don't have any imagination. When you don't have as much memory, you've got to bluff your way out, you know, a little bit, as you all know, and that helps to exercise your imagination from first grade on, as you get more and more as you go along. And what he's getting at here is that you shouldn't be daunted by the situation, because he's angry that science has put man down and not really confronted his basic problems. They're so busy getting their PhD in one little section, one on a footnote, page so-and-so, that nobody's read the book, you see? And what he's trying to do is put the book together for you. This is what he's trying to do in these two. He's trying to put the book together on where is the science of man at right now. In a remarkable way, he sees and feels, and he's begun as a person who's been outside completely. He is a one who doesn't believe. The birth of his child, his first son, knocked that out of him. He couldn't remain an agnostic anymore with the wonder of this life before him, entrusted to him, and that moves him on. The way in which he continuously is brought is one of the beautiful things to watch. Christian Century ran in its January 9th edition this year. And a few years back in the November edition of Psychology Today, you have a great interview with Sam Keen with him. And in both of these, you see his growth, which he relates to here as he's dying, how real the Christian impact becomes to him. Finally, he says, I die with my faith and trust in Luther. And that's where I identify. And his dying word is Calvin. Thou bruisest me, but it is thou. In his 40s, he's dying of cancer of the stomach. So there's a remarkable growth situation in this person that's exciting to follow through his works. The three which indicate kind of this climax of it are Angels in Armor, from which we've read just the one chapter on the need of being open, because we are given to a God who allows us to be open, and yet the hazards of being open in a world where everybody else is running with his armor on, and you're going to get hurt. And another one of his sub-themes is that failure belongs to any kind of an ardent life. Any kind of a committed life is going to know failure. And so he also needs to know where the supports are in taking his failure so that it does not lead to the sin of sadness, but permits him to be part of the exuberance of the prophets, who from the beginning have had to dance with joy when they had this kind of a situation. He's reevaluating Freud. He has some fine things to say about him in both Escape from Evil and Denial of Death, but he also shows up where he fails us, because he creates his own private religion. The people who have been under that religion on the psychiatric couch, of course, are owing him everything, so they have transferred their particular God identity is Freud. And to speak against Freud diminishes their immortality project. This is the word he uses from Otto Rank, and anybody who threatens the group with whom you identify is evil and wrong. Because you have assaulted their particular God ideal. But he does do this, and yet he shows you what is still available in terms of Freud's particular contribution that can be seized upon and used to help you in fighting this deification of the group ego, which he says will destroy planet Earth, and which we know it will as well. Escape from Evil especially deals with that aspect of it. I didn't finish the other night. You're certainly welcome to interrupt, ask any questions that's been you've been brooding on since the other night. But I will start tonight with this book a little bit and then turn to the other in closing. Remember that we have a few key phrases that he's used, that when you look at the human scene, the majority of men are tranquilizing themselves with the trivial. They never face up with their own terror of death and extinction, because it's too much for them, and they find their escapes. And their great escape, of course, is in the group, in the community which they belong, because every kind of a cultural structure is an immortality project. It's an attempt to allow man a little breather over against the existential terror that he feels he cannot confront, because he can't handle it. He can't live with it. We used cancer ward introducing this last time, and what the old superintendent of the cancer sanatorium was saying about the present superintendent when she came to see him, and he and she both realized she had cancer. And he said, modern man who has done so much, the one great thing he can't confront is his own death. And he deals with this, and why it's at that particular point now in ours, and why then we have to build up the lie and live in a lie about ourselves, our own character, the character lie, and so on. Now, I'm just going to read here in this particular book a part of the summary, really. It's part of the summary that he comes to when he says, the fact is that men cannot and do not stand on their own powers. It's on page 162 in Escape from Evil. Thank you, Karen. The fact is that men cannot and do not stand on their own powers. Right at the top of the page, I'm going to start off with. Therefore, they cannot make death their own. Moral dependence, guilt, is a natural motive of the human condition and has to be absolved from something beyond oneself. Remember, an angel is an armor. He says that the one thing he's learned from his life, the greatest meaning would be this, that Kierkegaard is a greater psychologist than Freud because he was aware of this, that the release had to come from without. You couldn't come at it with psychiatry. He loves Otto Rank because Otto Rank has gone further than this and see that man is not a psychological animal, he's a theological animal. And his only hope is to be rescued from without. As Rank says, it has to be a God from without him, from outside of him. One young revolutionary once admonished me for saying that guilt is not a motive. He never saw that his guilt was absorbed by submission to the revolutionary self. The weakness of the Enlightenment then was that it did not understand human nature, and it apparently still does not, as it won't look at man as being other than nice and good and potentials for freedom and so on. It won't see him in his enslavement to terror under death. Marcuse, in an eloquent line, asks for good conscience to be a coward, the uprooting of heroic sublimation. But this is too easy. Even if men admit they are cowards, they still want to be saved. There is no harmonious development, no child-rearing program, no self-reliance that would take away from men their need for a beyond on which to base the meaning of their lives. The fallacy of vulgar Marxism was that it overlooked the depth and universality of the fear of death. Marcuse has remedied this. The other fallacy was to fail to see the naturalness of existential guilt. And here Marcuse likewise fails. Marcuse was a hero of the particular student world that he knew. He's now passé, but he was sort of the favorite guru of the young adult of the 60s. He had one good statement that I would say has meant a lot for me, and these two guys beside me certainly show they've bought it too. There's no such thing, he says, as setting up a, the words he uses for it, Mary, I forget just how, but it's, you can't store up leisure over against the ultimate end, because you don't know when the ultimate end happens. You better take your leisure now. You may not get there. That's one of the things. How do you put it? You can't bank, huh?
You can't bank your retirement.
Yeah, you can't bank your retirement. People, which he saw in American situation, people could take the kind of slavery to this day, thinking someday I will have some freedom, and it won't be there. But he was very much listened to as he comes out of what's called the Frankfurt School, which was an endeavor to make a closure between Freud and Marx, and to put Freud and Marx together. And the Frankfurt School has had some very brilliant proponents in both our country and Germany. In fact, Alex Funke, who is here from Beethoven this summer, still thinks it's perhaps number one in the support it gives to the gospel message. And really what what he's trying to do is what the Frankfurt School did do in Germany. And Mark Kuss is one of their people here. Okay, the fallacy was to fail to see the naturalness of existential guilt. And Mark Kuss doesn't do this. The task of social theory is to show how society aggravates and uses natural fears. But there's no way to get rid of the fear simply by showing how leaders use them or by saying that men must take them in hand. Men will still take one another's heads because their own heads stick out and they feel exposed and guilty. The task of social theory is not to explain guilt away or to absorb it unthinkingly and instill another destructive ideology, but to neutralize it and give it expression in truly creative and life-enhancing ideologies.
That
what you need to do is to find that kind of a community in which you are supportive without betraying yourself by making it an idol. For instance, there's nothing wrong in being a Roman Catholic or Lutheran or so on. You've got to start somewhere, and we're all born somewhere. But it is wrong to make that into your own little idolatry with the blinders on over against what all others have, so that you are enhancing their enhancing. Then your life becomes enriched in the interchange. This is what he's talking about, how this can happen. Instead of knocking down the other guy, because that's the only way, I go up if he goes down, see? If you're wrong, I'm more right. You know, that kind of it's unending.
I would like to speak to this very point.
Yeah.
And I would say that the ocean shores, Galilean Chapel is an excellent example of. We have in the church 415 members now in a community of maybe a little over 1,200. And we represent 29 different denominations, and we just have a ball.
Oh, this is interesting. Exactly this sort of thing. And he says, it's, if that can happen, and see, they're not living for an establishment, you see. They're living for a mission that's constantly centered in the person that
the
comes.
The Lutheran Church backs it and just backs it every inch of the way.
Yeah, that's right. But this is what we're hoping to see more of. See, this is what this church I talked at in Champlin is trying to be, too, in one of the suburbs of Minneapolis. Well, here, like he says, to get into creative, he says, I'll read here a little bit more here. He says, what we have to find is a combination of Marxist critical thought and the tragic dimension, a perspective to the inevitabilities of human unfreedom. In this, the science would share a place with historical religions. They are all critiques of false perceptions, of ignoble hero systems. A science of society, in other words, will be a study similar to the one envisioned by Old Testament prophets, Augustine, Kierkegaard, Max Scheler, William Hawking, and so on. Hawking, I was a little surprised to see in that deal, I'll admit. It will be a critique of idolatry, of the costs of a too narrow focus for the dramatization of man's need for power and expiation. So we have to find some way, says Norman Brown's word, the return of the repressed, to find the new energies released which out of terror man hides and hides from. And he says, both religion and psychoanalysis have discovered the same source of the illusion, which is destroying man, the fear of death which cripples life. Also, religion has the same difficult mission as Freud, to overcome the fear of self-knowledge. Self-knowledge is the hardest human task because it risks revealing to the person how his self-esteem was built on the powers of others in order to deny his own creatureliness and death. Character is the vital lie that covers the painful ambiguities of man's worm godlikeness, the despair of the human condition, the miraculousness of it tightly interwoven with the stink and decay of it. So you need two statements, is what he's getting at, to realize that men deny themselves both their godlikeness and their wormlikeness. But religion overcame this double denial by maintaining that for God everything is possible. It's Luther's war cry, it's his baptismal word that we have up in our village, that God is continually taking beggars and making them kings. The two statements. This is continually new happening for each of you, that you are becoming kings and queens under the King of Kings and Queens, because this is what God is about. But he does this, as we know, our own worm-likeness, and it isn't in us, that it has to come from without. That with God everything is possible, as we've heard in our excellent Vespers here while I've been around. What seems to man to be fixed and determined for all time beyond human worm-like powers is for God free and open to do with what he will. Becomes his impossible possibility. And so this next paragraph. This gave the possibility of a new heroism, the heroism of sainthood. This meant living in primary awe at the miracle of the created object, including oneself in one's own godlikeness. Remember the awesome fascination of St. Francis with the revelations of the everyday world, a bird, a flower. It also meant unafraidness of one's own death, because of the incomparable majesty and power of God. And so religion overcomes the specific problems of fear-stricken animals, while at the same time showing them what empirical reality really is. If we were not fear-stricken animals who repressed awareness of ourselves and our world, then we would live in peace and unafraid of death, trusting to the Creator God and celebrating His creation. The ideal of religious sainthood, like that of psychoanalysis, is thus the opening up of perception. This is where religion and science meet. Now he goes on to say that this doesn't mean that science is an organized religion. You have a congregation like you heard Mark here talk to. You have, I think, the concern of the synod that that's what we develop. Before Dave Preuss became president of the ALC, he had over to his home one evening. This is when Kent was ill, and he'd asked all the men who were pastors in parishes giving more than $100,000 a year to the budget. And he'd asked me to come along, so I said, if Johan can come too, fine. Yeah, I said, Johan's most welcome. So we went over to listen, and each of them were saying what important things their particular congregation was doing. And then finally, he said, after it was all over, because he'd asked me to speak to it for what the village does, in a very simple way, of course, just opening up the mystery of each person to each other, so there's a community in the mystery of each other, no longer putting each other down, but building one another up. And he says, it seems to me that what we've missed is the whole function of the congregation is finding the lonely and the lost and leading them into the family of God. So they are once more enhanced and enriched with this awareness of what they are in God's sight and ours, brothers and sisters beloved in the Lord. And of course, that's really what we are about. And it was kind of good. He says, I think we've gone so far in the social route that all you're talking about, what you're doing, this external side on a theology of liberation, as we call it, and you've forgotten that what does happen now in the theology of reconciliation, you don't wait for tomorrow for that. Today, you know, you're one with God and one with each other. It may not be, it may be some days before you can find some kind of a better justice, for instance, in our school system today, where the kids are being exposed to going 12 years and ending up with nothing but a piece of paper, which they can't read. So it's, you have to fight a little while for some of that. He said, it's quite a little sentence here. Today, religionists wonder, this is the top of page 164. Today, religionists wonder why youth has abandoned the churches, not wanting to realize that it is precisely because organized religion openly subscribes to a commercial industrial hero system that is almost openly defunct. It so obviously denies reality, builds war machines against death, and banishes sacredness with bureaucratic dedication. I thought that was just a great line. Banishes sacredness with bureaucratic dedication. How easily this happens to us, you know. Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things. One thing is needful. Mary's chosen the better part, you see. Men are treated as things, and the world is pulled down to their size. The churches subscribe to this empty heroics of possession, display, manipulation. I think that today Christianity is in trouble, not because its myths are dead, but because it does not offer its ideal of heroic sainthood as an immediate personal one to be lived by all believers. In a perverse way, the churches have turned their backs both on the miraculousness of creation and on the need to do something heroic in this world. And this is what he speaks to here. He says, its early promise Christianity did not fulfill in giving mankind a hero system. So all through its history, the churches still bless unheroic wars and sanctify group hatred and victim age. See, we call ourselves by those group ego names. Norwegian Lutheran Church. You know, Finnish Lutheran Church. Here, man spricht Deutsch, you know. It's fine. We have to serve under these kind of small T's. But then they became so that was it. And they couldn't escape from it. And so he goes on to say that I'll just read a little bit more on this here. It is an age-old story, known to all, so there's no point in lingering on it, but these kinds of betrayal of an ideal heroism seems to be more and more obvious to today's youth. I think this is where this helps you to get onto it, so you don't get taken by it, see? They're even becoming obvious to the organized religions themselves, which are wondering how to divorce themselves from defunct hero systems and recapture the imaginations and the heroic impulses that are stifled in the youth. One way, of course, is by reaffirmation of traditional evangelism, which still seems to offer a way to overcome exaggerated fears of life and death by heroic dedication to special purity and worthiness. This article in the late National Geographic, is it this last month, that some of you read too with me, where this guy's starting a hike from up there in New England and down through the South, and then runs into an evangelist from Texas. Remember? It's really delightful. He was captured by it, and suddenly he was aware he didn't have to go to any more wild parties. He was on the wildest one of all, with Jesus Christ. In the United States today, courageous priests like Daniel Berrigan and so on are proving this truth, that society will move against religious sainthood, heroism, when it poses a threat to its own system of heroic apotheosis, no matter how self-defeating and immoral that system has become. In other words, you're interfering with the patriotic group ego and better shut up guy and talk your religion in church. Then above on page 165, he says simply, man simply cannot accept human limitations as inevitable in the scheme of things. If we talk about the devil side of human nature and about man's depravity, we cannot be fatalist or cynical about them. If we are skeptical about utopia and acknowledge the devil, it is only the better to fight for the angel side. And this is what he says, so that you get some leverage over against a traditional herd patriotism, and so on. And don't allow the group ego to kind of hold you in its, in Stowe says, for through the ideology of death, power, immortality, just like the shamans and the kings once did, and dominates them with it. How do we get rid of the power to mystify and see the situation the way it is what he talks to. And so he concludes these two books, really, that we can confront our own death, that it's possible to see a way of life in which it is not organized around continual self-deceit and the lie, and that there is a call to the heroic that meets the need of this time, so that that is the last word he wrote before he died. I return to the denial of death to read a little bit there in this particular chapter after the problem of Freud's characters, chapter 7. He says that the best thing Freud ever did, page 132, is group psychology and the analysis of the ego. And he's showing that man is but a horde animal led by a chief. But, and then he goes on to say here, what this really means, he believes Penschel has put it better, the longing for being hypnotized because we don't want to get back, because we want to get back to the magical protection, the feeling of back to the womb, of being cared for by the parent and so on, that the leader gives when you allow him to do this to it. The oceanic feeling that they enjoyed when they were loved and protected by their parents. And this is what the group ego does under that second category that we had on the wall the other night, the heteronomous. And so it gives him the satisfaction of what God gives to us who are in the faith, that they're cared for, that they don't have to worry, they can give themselves over to their leaders. And and he says this happens, middle of page 139, because the real world is simply too terrible to admit. It tells man that he is a small, trembling animal who will decay and die. Illusions change all this, makes man seem important, vital to the universe, immortal in some way. Who transmits this illusion, if not the parents, by imparting the macro lie of the cultural causa sui, that is your own product. The masses look to the leaders to give them just the untruth that they need. The leader continues the illusions that triumph over the castration complex and manifests them into a truly heroic victory. Furthermore, he makes possible new experience, the expression of forbidden impulses, secret wishes, and fantasies. In group behavior, anything goes because the leader okays it. It's like being an omnipotent infant again, encouraged by the parent to indulge oneself plentifully, or like being in psychoanalytic therapy, where the analyst doesn't censure you for anything you feel or think. In the group, each man seems an omnipotent hero, who can give full vent to his appetites under the approving eye of the Father. And so we understand the terrifying sadism of group activity. And on the next page, on 134, he says this kind of incestuous symbiosis of the group and you. Those who belong are those who are like me, those who are unlike me are out. And you build up this einer von unser vielen, this in-group, and you're in the prison of the motherly, racial, national, religious fixation. And he says, what gets him so angry, science has paid so little attention to this aspect of our human existence. He says, the astonishing thing is that this central line of work on the problem of freedom since the Enlightenment occupies so little of the concern and ongoing activity of scientists. It should then form the largest body of theoretical and empirical work in the human sciences if these sciences are to have any human meaning. How we can get a hold of these then and relate to them and act them so we're not taken in by them, so that this aspect of transference, of turning your own little world that won't make it into the group, and the group will make it for you, and so you can, as he says, hate. Now hate enlivens you, and the group can hate each other. We all know some 1984 and Brave New World and so on. And it scares you when you read those books or see the movies on them, how easily we can give ourselves over to this. It was simply startling for me, coming as I did out of an environment in which we'd had no radio, no newspaper, nothing to in any way gauge what was happening. And then suddenly we're released from our Japanese prison and put down in America, and we realize that the Americans have moved heaven and hell. And that was the first thing I was startled about. The second thing was the girls now admit they like boys and were chasing them because there were so few of them. But the other thing was we had moved heaven and hell. Give them hell. And that was over there where hell was, and we were where heaven was. And it just made me aghast at what we were doing to ourselves. And I knew what we'd run into, and we did. When our occupation army hit Germany, of course, they went all to pieces. They could drink the water first time in Europe. These people are just like us, and they weren't demons walking around with tails behind their legs, and our morale just went shot. It's a bleak history in our history of our country, our occupation forces in Germany, as you know. And we left an awful lot of dark-skinned babes behind out of it, too, and so on. It was just sort of an explosion of evil on our part, just because we felt we'd been taken and we'd been given a big lie. And like, I'm just reading Barth at this moment, just in the same, he says, and he said in his letter to America, this is Karl Barth's letter to America, you can only fight this war with good conscience as Christians if you're fighting it for the sake of the Germans. Okay. Quite a little statement, but that's right. We asked one of the new converts out there when we released, beautiful guy, Paul, big tall fellow, he got hit when they overran our prison again, and the Japanese overran, and we called out as we've been taking out, and this sergeant had just lifted me up into the Jeep because I couldn't even lift my legs that high, and I yelled out, anybody know where Paul is? And somebody, I'm his buddy, he got hit. I said, how bad? Beautiful, enough to send him home, but not all the way home. You know, and that was right in the midst of it there. Well, Paul had just said to us the day before, he was a Missouri Synod pastor's son who got converted by a chaplain from another small T than that particular T, so it was really bothering his folks, Church of God chaplain that reached him. But he said, I fight with a good conscience because I'm fighting for the sake of the Japanese. Just what he said. And this is right. This is the way a Christian can be a soldier in that sense. You can't beat out of vindictiveness and give him hell, you see. Well, this is what he's speaking to. What? Yes, it is. That's what the chaplain corps should be doing. You see, this is what they're there for.
Jack Lowe had a really good session on that too. What would have happened if the Christians had considered the war in Germany from that point of view?
Well, I'm going to read you a little bit more, and then we close for tonight, just because I got this crazy junk in my head. But I wanted to read just a little bit more again from Escape from Evil. On page, in the New Historical Forms of Immortality Power, page 64, he develops how these new historical forms of immortality power, these group egos develop, how they happen. I've got up above here, for instance, Missouri Synod and Jack Preuss. I've got beside here something we used to hear a lot of in our old ELC and used to drive me wild because it's absolutely a blasphemous statement. On page, in Escape from Evil, on page 64, because we can't say we have the truth. We can only say the truth has us, because he is the person. He is the truth, the way, the life. He has us. When we say we have the truth, we've just made ourselves into God, and there's no such thing, because we are only partially in the truth. The Apostle Paul said this, we know only fragmentarily. And good old early Barth was very clear on this. He said, all we can ever be is a marginal comment to the Scripture. A marginal comment, that's all. At the University of Chicago, it was fun listening to him there at that, because I'd spent all those earlier years there fighting all the time for just what he was saying, and now they were eating it up because they had lived a little longer and seen how right this kind of a gospel given is. And he was saying, you know, there was a time in our century when we were treating the Scripture like the Scripture was naughty little schoolboys and it wasn't quite right, and we were the professors leaning over the shoulder of Scriptures to make the corrections. But then we discovered, to our being startled, and this is just what happened to him, see, just exactly what happened to him, that instead the Scripture was looking over our shoulder and making marginal comments on our papers, on our statements. And it was fun to hear. Well, here's this on this group ego thing, because your particular generation, it can do something at this point here where our generation failed. We were still caught up in these tribalisms. And that's this is the way we are. I say with Mary and I, go to hell, it'll be because we've lived so close to our own tribe, we've forgotten how deeply enriched we've been through our small t tradition, that other traditions had nothing of it all and we never shared. She did write one book, at least, on our Christmas customs. This was one of the fun ones from St. Andrew's Day now in November until the 14th day after Christmas, 12th night. But we have been just blind to this oftentimes, living within our own little gang. University of Chicago challenged me on this way back in 1950. They said, the Norwegians don't want you. They only want your legs. We want all of you. Why don't you stay with us here, be on our faculty? I said, well, the Norwegians produced me. They got to live with me. He said, they won't want you. Just wait. 10 years, you'll be out. 10 years, I was out. Exactly. They were like prophets on that. But I felt this is where we could serve. I didn't say that because I thought that's where the truth was. As you know, we have all these as part of our faculty here, and you see here these 29 in that one congregation fund. That tremendous parish of Odessa, which is Holden Village down in Texas, with hardly two Lutherans at least to every square mile, and the group that's been pulled in to make an open community where you're free to make mistakes, as one person put it. And as another said, this whole area knows this is a church for sinners. And they come in, and they do. They baptize more adults there than we are in any one of our mission fields. Well, this is what happens in the excitement when the group ego goes and you see Jesus Christ as the one great T who unites us all, the one sacrifice for sin that makes possible no longer our making each other sacrifice. Because what he develops in escape from in denial of death, as well as here, is how we will sacrifice each other to our mediocrities. We can't take excellence. Anyone better off with his head? This is what the group ego does. It develops an intensive mediocrity finally, and it's its own destruction. And this is what he's talking about here now, which I'll read a little bit. He said the single principle for this group ego is the principle of immortality striving. Is universal to every culture. What was fixed was a principle of a dominant immortality ideology. In every historical period or social group, man thought that he lived absolute truth because his social life gave expression to his deepest innate hunger. And so Rank could say, every conflict over truth is in the last analysis just the same old struggle over immortality. You take my group through, you've diminished my immortality. I've got to fight you, you see. If anyone doubts this, let him try to explain in any other way the life and death viciousness of all ideological disputes. Each person nourishes his immortality in the ideology of self-perpetuation to which he gives his allegiance. I think of Hermann Preuss weeping when I lectured and said, it all depends on the way we say this, whether we've made ourselves as Lutherans into a sect or whether we exist for the whole Church of Jesus Christ. And that was the title to Hermann Sasse's book, Here We Stand. If we say, here we stand, you're out. But here we stand for the sake of the whole. And Herman said to me, crying, how could you do this to us? How could you do that to Sasse and Lutheran Church? I said, Herman, we're not a sect. See, we're not a sect. Jerry Pelican begged me not to give that lecture. He says, you'll never make it in a Luther seminary afterwards. He was supposed to be lecturing after he broke his leg, so he couldn't. I suppose it was stupid. All my father-in-law said, well, it took 10 years for them to get you up here to give these lectures, and it'll take another 100 before they'll ever let you stay around. But it's what we need to hear, otherwise the group ego won't go. See, we've only seen a softening here, but we haven't seen real decisive change. Now, you get it particularly, as Marcus said very well, in this one concrete situation, that's where it has to happen. It has to happen where you are. Remember, at the village, we still don't even have permission to have the Eucharist. We have it. They agree to look the other way. And with the Eucharist, all are present. Who believe is the words declare, this is my body, this is my blood. Your handout, you receive. We don't ask how many years you've had a confirmation or if you've ever been baptized in the Lutheran Church. You're here because God has sent you to be part of the celebration. And this keeps us from making the village into an immortality project of our own. And so I'll turn over to the next page here a little bit.
Carol?
Yes.
Excuse me before you go on. That statement that you read at the beginning of that section where he says, in each historical period or social group, man thought that he lived absolute truth because his social life gave expression to his deepest innate hunger.
Yeah.
That statement, when I read that, really grabbed me. It's I remember a long time ago when I asked you about the idea of sarx or flesh.
Yeah.
I think this is a statement of that, is it not?
This is
our social thing is giving us back. We're sort of living in a tension with our hungers, and whoever answers that, we say, that must be God.
Yeah.
Something like that.
You see, each culture does this. Each culture does this within its own context. And there are some, you can't annihilate it either. Like you said, you've got to live where you're at, but it's to become open and objective to this, that's what's happening, and not become like Mary was up for ambassador to Norway, and I wanted her to get it because I would get free cigars and cognac and so on, and she wouldn't run at all. She says, I can't stand successful Norwegians, and that's what you're with. They're always so pompous, and they are. They're just about impossible. If there's something that'd be more pompous than a successful Norwegian, I haven't met him. He's worse than a pompous Swede, even. Pompous Swede's a little more civil, whereas the Norwegian just talks about himself. He does. I mean, this is a fact. The scholars joke, on the elephant. The Germans put out a big encyclopedia on the elephant, and the French put out a little slim volume on the sex life of the elephant, and the Americans put out a catalog on how to raise bigger and better elephants cheaper, and the Norwegians write all about the Norwegians. and the Swedes write on what we Swedes did for the elephant in World War II. And I never tell the story because there are always Finns around and I don't want to hurt them, but it still is so true for each of them. And the Finns write, what do the elephants think of us Finn? but we have these national characteristics, you see. And that is an immortality. And you can't say anything against it, you see. Say anything against it. Here we got somebody who's a quisling and should be shot. He doesn't know we Norwegians walk taller than anybody else on the earth. Well, all these, he says, are life enriching for them, and they preserve their immortality rather than their lives. They lose their lives for these immortality projects, he says. And this is the sorrow, because they're going to be fighting over against each other. Planet Earth isn't big enough to contain it. And that's where we have to come to, where we're able to come to grips with ourselves, our own guilt, our need of forgiveness and acceptance, the other person's, and discover a new kind of community and relationship to planet Earth that doesn't destroy the very environment which nourishes us. And this comes out pretty clear, you see. And there comes almost a race between us, if these group egos, into which one can enjoy the most before there isn't any more of it, you know? That's what's happening right now, really. Any questions we got over against this tonight and last time? I'm not going to have more with Becker because you have to read it and chew it and discuss it back and forth as you go through. There's an awful lot here. The great thing that he has done, as I see it, is that he has taken away any kind of a perfectionism. There's no big idea. There's no joining up with the communists to make this come or voting in socialism or so on. It begins in the context of the concrete particularity where you are and works out through where you yourself are identified in the communities that you yourself share and which enrich you and which you enrich again. And so within that kind of a context, something can happen that will destroy the power of these group egos for us. Obviously, one friend keeps you from being taken in by them, because with him you dare talk and you realize how you're really reacting. But if he's not a friend, and you got to worry lest he's going to, you know, give you up to the Gestapo of whatever shape those Gestapos have, then you can't know what you yourself are thinking. See, I started a printing series, for instance, in the Lutheran Church, because I realized that we were running scared. We hadn't had any theology for over 30 years. The church was afraid to hear its voice talk aloud. All we could do is repeat dogma, which is another thing. Receive truth from way back when. It doesn't win anybody. It only reassures you that you're in the idolatry of your particular tea. That's all. Well, when I started the Fullness series, it was fun to do, because I went out with the man who was the Defensor Fide, the defender of the faith at that time, and really a marvelous guy and a great pastor, but not too good of mine, and always uptight about defending the Lutheran position. And a beautiful guy, really, in lots of ways. His bishop was with him. I had my cousin with me, and we had a Chinese dinner, and we got talking. I said, now, what I want to do is to trust the man. Rudy, I said, you're going to get mad at the things they say. You can destroy this before I can get it off the printing press. I said, you got to let him live. We're going to trust the guy, even if we're not sure about what he's saying. But we've got to come to this point, or we'll never have a theology. And Rudy says, you know, it's funny, just last Sunday, there I was preaching, I wondered, is this orthodox? It's too late now. I said, Rudy, that's when you're effective. That's when you're effective. He says, yes, why is it? I said, because that's when the gospel is actually shaping it. Now, Fritz Norsen said the same thing to him at the district meeting, or Rudy's giving a little time. He says, Rudy, you can tell us anything you want, and we know when you go back home, you never lose the person, that you're a pastor and not a guy out fighting with your sword to defend the faith. You're going to be there for that guy that's there, which he was. I mean, the guy himself was a lot greater than the head he was carrying on his shoulders, actually. But this is the problem you have in dealing with this group ego thing. And it will happen to you over and over. As it was, he never did attack. He laid low. Eastfold almost had a heart attack when the book came out from one of his faculty members in this area on time. And fortunately, the man was in Europe right then, or he would have lost his position right then. In order for us to win Eastfold around, we had to be very clever. And Erling Thompson, the pastor over at Trinity, had a bunch of the books. All the fellows who were in for Lutheran World Federation meeting that summer were given a copy of the book to read the night before they saw Eastfold. They talked about it the next morning. You got a guy's thinking like this. We didn't think anybody in America thought. This is great. You know, I tried to get him on St. Olaf. It's history faculty was full. Tried to get him on Don Augustine, Rock Island, at Sioux Falls. Their faculty was full on historians. I thought, oh boy, he comes back from Europe and he's going to face finding a job just because I got him to go stick his neck out and write this book. But what happened to Walt was really fun when he came back, because Eastfold had given the devil a full professorship if it aided the image of Pacific Lutheran, you know. He made him a full professor. It's one of those funny things behind the scene. And you should have heard him at the top of his voice the whole way to Minneapolis with me once, arguing as we sat there, and the hostess after said, my, I've never seen Eastfold this upset. I said, well, you should be, because I said, you start throwing stones, Seth. Remember, you're in a glass house. You've got the craziest notion of the end time on earth that any guy's ever had walking in a Lutheran church, which he did. He had all kinds of screwed up ideas he picked up from the Southern Baptists, you know, like you see in the back bumpers. Now, watch it. This fellow is liable to suddenly disappear. And his car is going to be wrecking yours on the road, so be careful. That was when Seth would have bought that completely. But anyway, the fun that we have in relating to our groups, we can become critical. At the same time, we're loyal. We're critical because we are loyal. I'm fighting for the church through the Lutheran understanding, and God giving me the will and the understanding, I'd like to write on the Book of Concord for its 400th anniversary soon. The one that was stolen from our altar here was worth $2,300, first edition. Somebody went off with it because it was parchment, looked good, and evidently we didn't appreciate it because we had it on our altar. But it means something to me. I practically memorized it in all, it's both of its original language, Latin and German, when I was in prison camp. And that's why nobody's ever attacked us while we were here, because it would have been suicide if they had. I could have cut them and quartered them with the Book of Concord. But we can't live out of that. What's great about it, that I'll show you, is you're always back at that new beginning. You're continually new. You're never beyond creeping back to your baptism. It's only a mere beginning. And this is over and over again stated in our church's confession. There's no triumphalism. And that's what I wanted to close on, because that's what is so clear here. Otto Rank says, all the great enemies of man have started out with a great idea for man. Any pinpoint, just show it. For instance, Danton and Robespierre were friends of man. They ended up beheading 250,000 of their fellow human beings for the idea, you see. The big idea will destroy planet Earth, is what he's saying. It's another triumphalism, it's another immortality project, and it's not one-to-one, you see. Because everything that really will happen is one-to-one. Otherwise, God could have saved this world by sending down records to begin with, couldn't he? Just, or tapes. Thank you.
Thank you.